A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Changes. It is Annie here, and we are finishing this whole series with a fantastic episode. One of the most recognisable and successful broadcasters in the UK, Gabby Logan, is here to talk through her changes. Gabby is an absolute trailblazer when it comes to sports broadcasting. Her career has seen her work for ITV, Sky and the BBC, presenting many of the biggest sporting events, including the Olympic Games, the Commonwealth Games, the World Cup and also the 2022 Euros, which changed the face of British women's football when the Lionesses won, led by former guest of Changes and England captain Leah Williamson. Now, Gabby has an MBE for services to sports broadcasting and promoting women in sport. And on top of that, she's a writer, having written for multiple publications, as well as writing a memoir, The First Half. Her podcast, The Midpoint, has been running since 2020 and involves speaking to all sorts of guests about midlife. And this month, she launched a brand new podcast, The Sports Agents, the sister podcast of The News Agents, which she co-hosts with fellow broadcaster and ex-colleague of mine, Mark Chapman. There is clearly no holding back for Gabby Logan. It's brilliant to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on. How are you?
I'm really good. Honestly, like in researching you, Gabby, I'm kind of like in awe. What have been some of the biggest changes you have been privy to since you began working as a sports broadcaster?
Well, that's such a great question, because it actually is, you know, really, I would look back on those kind of almost 30 years in broadcasting so far and seen change as the word that kind of dominates actually everything in terms of my feelings about that 30 years, you know, enjoyments there and passion and, you know, hard work and tenacity and all those things. But actually change is the thing that I feel encapsulates it all the most, because first of all, I didn't want to be a sports broadcaster necessarily. I just wanted to work, you know, in telly, journalism, radio. Right. And then I accidentally found myself in sport because of my passion for sport, my background in sport, and in an opening, you know, and somebody realizing that perhaps things needed to be a bit more representative. And I was there at the right time and enjoyed it. And then when I got into sports broadcasting, it was a very male place, obviously, you know, that's 30 years ago. And suddenly, you know, kind of not suddenly, actually, because you don't turn a tanker suddenly. And that's what it feels like. It's the turning of a tanker. Yeah. But it feels sudden in the sense that when I look back, it feels 2 minutes since I walked into Sky as a 23-year-old. And now I look back over those 27 years and we've got many women in front of camera, many women in, you know, behind the mic, but also more importantly for me, women directors, producers, camera women, heads of sport, you know, heads of the sports departments on newspapers and websites. So that feels like a massive change, that the industry is so much more inclusive, both for gender, but also ethnicity, diversity and background. All those things are really important. So there's been huge change. And then that change is reflected not just in what you see on TV and you hear on radio, but also what you might then experience when you're at a sporting event, because the crowd is different, you know. So, right. And I think that leads to a much more lovely kind of experience at a football match or, you know, whatever it is, a rugby game, wherever you're going, if there's a balance of people in the stand. So, and then the next part of that change is the rise of women's sport, you know, and that has also been probably the last 10 years, the most incredible change.
Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 50.
50? Yeah. Wow. How do you feel about turning 50?
Well, it was funny because my husband was 50 the year before me and I'd thrown him a big surprise party and it was a big thing. And then when I turned 50, it felt like a bit like after the Lord Mayor's show, you know, kind of we'd had this kind of talk about being 50 and then it was like, oh, I'm 52. Actually, I really don't mind it at all. I don't mind it at all. One of my colleagues is 60. Sonia McLaughlin, she won't mind me saying that. And she said that she found 60 much harder than 50. 50 felt great. She felt like she got everything sorted. And that is kind of how it feels a little bit, actually. This is going to be a great decade, you know? This is, but then you don't know what's around the corner, do you? And I think that's the thing my husband and I have always kind of very much aligned on philosophically. You know, he's had a rough couple of years. He had prostate cancer a couple of years ago. That came kind of like a bolt from the blue. You know, this is really fit guy who kind of had no symptoms at all.
Yeah.
So I think we've always been quite carpe diem, but that was much more of a kind of, okay, yeah, life is going to throw surprises and curveballs. So while it looks like a great decade ahead and things look exciting, I know there are going to be challenges.
Yeah. Let's get to change now, Gabby, if that's all right. And your first change, we asked you, what was the biggest change of your childhood?
The biggest change of my childhood, I think, was going to live in a foreign country when I was 9 years old. My dad was a footballer, and we always kind of had this mentality that we might be moving at any time, because that's what footballers do. So we never ever kind of were scared of moving, but usually it was between cities in the UK, and we'd moved from Leeds to Coventry, where he played.
Can I ask who we is? Who was the family unit?
Yeah, we is me. At the time, it was me and my mum, dad. I'm the eldest. My sister Louise, who's 11 months younger than me, Irish twin. And my brother Daniel, who is was 3 years younger than me. We didn't have my brother Jordan at this point. He was a kind of much bigger gap. It came later. And so my dad transferred to Vancouver Whitecaps in Canada. And we all moved to Canada. This was a massive change, you know, from Coventry to Vancouver was just huge in terms of culturally. It's very different. It was a really amazing outdoor lifestyle. So we had mountains, sea, a school which was all about sport. Every day you did something. And while we'd always all done sporty things and been sporty, this was a whole different level in Vancouver. Such a great experience for about 18 months. It cemented in all of us a real passion for sport and for being outside. And what you get from, my mum was always very much about doing as many different things as you can and, you know, trying lots of different things. And she was often quite, you know, doing it alone, because my dad in Vancouver had to go off for away games, could be a 7 hour flight away. So they sometimes took them away for 2 weeks and played three games on the road and then came back. So so she was doing all this in a foreign country on her own, effectively. Yeah.
She must have been very tough.
Yeah, she's tough. Yeah, she's very tough. And she's also, she wasn't scared of risk when I look back. You know, I was 10 when I was there. I think I was about 10, maybe I was 9. And my friend at school had a house in Palm Springs, as you do. And she wanted to take me for Easter. And my mum, I heard my mum on the phone saying no. And I said, Mum, when she put the phone down, I said, why? And she said, well, you know, you're only 9 and you can't fly down there on your own, because I have to fly to meet them. You can't fly down on your own. And I said, why? Why can't I? And I basically argued the toss for long enough that she gave in and called the mum back and said I could go. So I had, you know, I had this experience of flying to Palm Springs on my own and, you know, staying with them and having, and they were very, very loose liberal parents. I don't think we saw the parents for 7 or 8 days. You know, we just played tennis all day and ran around having fun. And so that was so different to my life in Coventry and you know, how we'd been living thus far in life. I think it really was, when I look back, an important period in terms of who I was to become and what my joys in life were going to be from.
And what kind of kid were you? I mean, it sounds like you were pretty tenacious.
I think as the eldest, it's a cliche, but the eldest child usually is quite good at organizing stuff, aren't they? And getting things done and, you know, being the trade union rep when they need to, you know, giving and also sorting out things for the others and taking leadership roles. And I suppose I did those kinds of things quite naturally as a kid. And I was also quite independent. My mum always says that when, in fact, that trip she points as an example, that when she was at the gate saying goodbye, apparently I didn't turn around.
Getting on the plane?
Well, she waved goodbye at me at the gate, and they had this a representative from the airline, and she was expecting me to turn around and blow her a kiss, and apparently I just carried on chatting to the lady and never turned around. So I think I'm going back to what I was saying about my mum. I think I was quite fearless because she had given me that freedom to be fearless, you know, and didn't shroud us with cotton wool saying stay at home and don't do something that could involve risk. And I think that's really important for kids to experience the bumps and bruises metaphorically as well as literally in life, and have to deal with that, you know, things that are sometimes disappointing, which is where sport, I think, played a really important part in our lives, because sport presents disappointment quite regularly and you have to learn to deal with that and treat it as something else, because otherwise you wouldn't go back. There were a lot of interesting and creative and personality creating experiences that happened there, and definitely her toughness and resilience was a big factor in that.
And so you chose gymnastics as your kind of sport to really go for, and you excelled hugely in that. You know, you were at the Commonwealth Games for that, like representing Wales. What was it about gymnastics, do you think, that you were so attracted to?
Do you know, I think it was convenience, because at the time I wanted to be a tennis player, and we came back from Canada. That was my sport. That's all I wanted to do. There were no tennis courts in Leeds where we came back to that were indoor in the wintertime. We came back in the October. There was one indoor court. It was a private club that cost a fortune to be a member of. And so there were some public courts. And my mum said, oh, you can have lessons there. Of course, they take the nets away about 3 weeks after Wimbledon. They don't put them back till about 3 weeks before Wimbledon. So I couldn't physically play the sport that I really loved. So my sister, who was more into gymnastics than me, and I just went along with her to the gym club. And I got sucked in, loved it. And it ended up being my thing.
And you did that all the way through your teens?
Yeah.
Into your 20s? Is that
correct? No, it was A-levels. In the middle of A-levels when I was at the Commonwealth Games, I developed quite bad sciatica, which it was so painful and so debilitating by the end that I would get out of bed and my left leg would kind of give way, and I was just in such bits with it and having lots of treatment, had to have a bit of time off. And I think it was, had it happened to me 2 years before, I would have pushed through because I would have wanted to get to the Commonwealth Games, or I wanted to get to the Olympics.
Right.
And it was about 2 years from the Olympics at this point, and which was, would have been the one that I was aiming for. And I just was doing my levels and feeling, okay, this is not going to get much better. These other girls are coming, you know, for me, and they're coming past me, and I'm not going to be as good as them. I've got a year to go on these A-levels. I could really crack on and get a good set of A-levels. I wanted to go to university. And I think I just made quite a pragmatic choice, because gymnastics was never going to be a job for me. It was never going to be a career. You didn't earn a penny out of it. So I could, you know, see that I would spend that time doing something and perhaps then not get the A-levels I needed, not be able to go to the university I wanted to. And it was heartbreak to say goodbye to it, because I didn't think I would ever find anything in life that would give me the joy and the sense of achievement and the buzz of competing and training for something. And that is really, at that age, you know, it's everything. It's your everything. It's your world. So I really felt like I'd hit my high point in life. I remember saying to somebody, oh, that's it for me now. Life's going to be really mundane and really boring because I don't have that anymore.
Okay, so let's get to the biggest change of your adult life now. So this was quite close to that period of your life, so post A-levels. Can you talk me through what that would have been, please?
The biggest change in my life has been the death of my brother when I was 19, and he was 15, almost 16 at the time. And this came, as you just pointed out there, not long after this period of seismic kind of change as well in my, who I was, who I thought I was as a gymnast. But actually it was, I was on my way, I was on, you know, to kind of university. I'd had a gap year, it was at the end of the gap year. And his death was completely without warning, sudden death. He had a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and that meant that his heart was very enlarged and it just stopped, and there was no warning. So he was playing football in the garden with my dad after dinner one night, and I was living in London at the time on my gap year. My sister was in Japan, she was modeling, and he was with my little brother, who'd come along by now, Jordan, who was six at the time. And it was a Maybank holiday evening, and he collapsed, and that was it. And that then obviously led to huge change in all our worlds.
How did it change you, do you think? Now you have all of this time and hindsight. How does something like that change a person?
It's really hard, isn't it, when you're 19, to work out who you were going to be anyway and how much of the core of you was there. There was definitely an intensity and a desire to really live life to the full, which came out really quickly. I think I was already somebody who wanted to grab life by, you know, the neck and kind of go, right, okay, you know, let's go for it. But I think this really exacerbated that. And I had a real feeling of not wanting to waste a moment and wanting to make sure that his life was somehow lived out in another way, you know, and that I had this opportunity that he didn't have, because he was incredibly talented footballer. He'd signed for Leeds United, who'd just won the old first division, so they were the top team in the country. He was destined for, you know, really great things. He'd already been scouted for Wales under 18s at 15 years old, and he had this amazing future, it looked like, and it just went like that. So I I suppose, wanted somehow to, you know, make sure that that wasn't forgotten and that somehow you could, you know, live two lives almost.
Yeah, yeah. How did the grief and the subsequent weeks, months, years change your family unit?
So what you find out about grief is that, first of all, there is no textbook that tells you how to grieve. There are lots of different ways that people are going to grieve, and they will find their way and their path. And of course, in a family of six, the five that were left did that in very different ways. And the time when you need to lean on somebody, it might not be the right time for them, you know, within that family unit. Yeah. And so I think with my parents, their relationship didn't survive ultimately. And it took them a while. It was a very slow kind of deterioration of their relationship, but ultimately they got divorced, and they honestly had been very happy, you know, just before, about right. 3 months before, they'd gone on holiday for the first time in their married life together to Thailand, because obviously they had two kids who'd already left school. My brother was about to become a footballer. They only had the little one, Jordan, left at home. And my mum said that on this holiday, they'd had the call, I think, at that point from my brother to say that, you know, the contract had been off and everything. And she said she put the phone down and she looked at my dad and she said there was this moment where she just felt like her babies all had their wings and they were flying. And so they, you know, they wouldn't have gone on a holiday like that had they not had a good relationship. You know, they wouldn't have wanted to spend 2 weeks together in Thailand. Yeah. And afterwards, I think when their sadness and their grief was overwhelming, it's very hard to remember those times and to think about, you know, being a great couple together, because you have so much sadness and so much disappointment. And in my dad's case, a lot of anger. You know, he was just really pissed off with life and he couldn't quite work out how he was going to love my brother who was six. How could he put all that investment, all that time and love, you know, and all that energy and love into something when it could all be taken away? And he, in a very kind of crude way, he just wanted to pull himself away from anything that could hurt him, I think.
Yeah.
And my mum was much more searching, wanted to work out what life was all about. What did life mean? She would visit priests and rabbis, and she'd go, and she saw something that was like a counselling, a group that, you know, of bereaved parents, anything like that, she would sign up for. And not immediately. I mean, for about a month, she barely moved, didn't wash her hair, could hardly put her clothes on. But once she got herself out the door, she was determined to try and make sense of things. And so their journeys and their pathways were so different. I don't think it was a surprise to any of us really that after a few years it was obvious that they weren't coming back on the same track. So that as a family is really hard, because my little brother was six and he never really got to experience what we did as kids. You know, we had this really great idyllic family life and always happy, very energetic, and he saw a lot more sadness and he saw separation, and he didn't have us at home as well. So I do feel sad for him, because he lost his big brother and then he lost his family around him, you know, that family unit that we'd all experienced. And our lives we were adults now, right? So we'd gone through that period, that happy childhood, and that nobody can ever take that away from you. Even though you know you're going to have to deal with this loss, you've still had
that solid kind of security of those first few years.
And I really feel enormously grateful for that, because I think it would be much harder to deal with as a little child. You know, there's definitely a before Daniel and an after Daniel. In terms of our lives.
And the nature of how he died, this sudden death, I suppose, how does this sense of life being able to just end at any point, how does that kind of awareness affect your living and affect the way you want to live your life moving forwards?
I was really determined that it wouldn't stop me trying things, exploring and taking risk in life, because I was granted that gift by my mum, as I said before, about, you know, going into situations that you were uncertain about and putting yourself out there and being ready to accept disappointment. And so I didn't want that to stop. And because I'd experienced this loss and not experienced the full range of emotions of life, which yeah. I really was experiencing the full range with what was happening with Daniel and all the in the aftermath of that, because grief can blindside you kind of years later. You know, I can be yeah. doing a speech somewhere for a charity and I'll suddenly just get it'll yeah. just come over me. And I did something at Harefield, which is the obviously a hospital synonymous with heart transplants. They had a beautiful garden that they built for the patients and their families, and I'd gone to open it and I'd met this man who'd lived, basically. He'd had a very similar thing to my brother, but he'd lived because somehow they caught it and he had a heart transplant and he'd helped raise this money, and we were talking and it just kind of a wave came over me, you know, and this poor guy, he's got this sobbing woman in front of him, because it just happened, you know, it just can. You never close yeah. the door on grief and say, thank you very much, we're done now. I've moved on. But I think that is also being open to the emotion is actually what's probably kept me quite sane and, you know, and on a healthy path mentally, because I think if you do lock it away and you don't let it out, it's going to come out in a way that you might not like, and it might not yeah. be the healthiest. It's so hard to look back at my life and not think that that changed me in a way. I'll never know really how, but I'm sure it is the most impactful change.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So moving on to your early 20s, you were working in Sky Sports. You got this wonderful job working with Sky Sports as a broadcaster, your first foray into sports broadcasting. How were those years? How do you look back on those years? And can you give me a tiny bit of context in terms of like you as a woman in that role?
It's difficult to look back and not smile. And I also, I'm always really mindful that I've said quite a lot about that period that was quite negative, you know, because some of the behaviours right. in the workplace were terrible. But I'm sure they were at places like Radio 1 or at places like, you know, the City of London, or if you're in a massive accountancy firm at that point as a woman.
It was culturally yeah, okay.
It was culturally okay.
To be misogynistic, to say casually, things, yeah, that all
were,
the time.
That were yeah. sometimes a bit hurtful, sometimes just pure sexist, sometimes, you know, way to crossing the line in terms of taste. And yet there were also a lot of good people and good guys who worked in those environments, because I wouldn't have stayed. I couldn't have stayed if it was full yeah. of people like that. And yeah, I think, yeah. you know, and ultimately you find the people who are your allies, don't you? And you don't realize at the time that's what they are. But I definitely gravitated towards those guys who were supportive and I wanted to learn from and were giving me opportunities. And they were all guys. You know, there were no female bosses. There were no women who were editing these shows. So it was also a period of time, I think, societally, where we had the ladette and we had all that culture going right. on as well. So which yeah. when you look back now, seems like a funny way to try and counter. But I understand perhaps why it was happening. You know,
define women in the lens of men. Like they yeah. can't just be women. They yeah. have to be like a type of a man.
Yeah. Exactly. But still somehow retaining enough of the female that we recognize them as such. And also we can find them attractive, but we kind of, you know, it was all very...
You have to behave like us in order for us to fight. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But can you still look like this, please? So... Yeah, and I was a bit uncomfortable with this anyway, because that wasn't really me. I wasn't massive like my kids. My son in particular takes a mick out of me because he's like, did you have any fun? Because I wasn't like somebody who wanted to go out all the time. I like socializing with my colleagues, but I definitely wasn't somebody who wanted to go on all dayers and things like that.
And so I
kind of prefer going for a run on a Sunday morning, and I want to wake up and feel good. And so I found my way through that period somehow. I think I did dip my toe into probably unhealthy lifestyles for a bit, slightly dodgy periods, and you get your tribe, don't you? It's like any period of life when you make change. And so I had a lot of fun. I really did enjoy living in, you know, in that part of town on my own, and having, you know, I was single, meeting lots of people. But when I left Sky and I went to ITV, it definitely felt like culturally things were shifting. And I don't know whether that was just because ITV was perhaps a more established, bigger operation at the time. Sky was still only 5 or 6 years old, Sky Sports. But I think it was probably more about things starting to change generally in society.
And did you see that reflect in the way that you broadcast? I'm interested in how you did your job. Mm. And I suppose that through the lens of being a woman surrounded by men.
Yeah, that's interesting, because my boss at ITV used to tell me off for loading my questions with too many facts. And he said, I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to convince everybody that you know stuff. He said, but I wouldn't have you here if I knew, you know, if I didn't think you knew your stuff.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And he said, look at what Des Lynam or Steve Ryder, the other, my contemporaries at ITV, said, they don't do that in their questions. They ask simple, basic questions because they want those facts to come out from the guest. And so I had to train myself to trust that it was okay. And Brian was very avuncular in lots of ways as a boss. I had gone to him and asked if I could do something. I'd been asked to host a show for IT. I can't remember what it was, for ITV Entertainment. And he said, no. And I said, what do you mean, no? He said, no, they don't trust you yet. I said, what? He said, the viewers. He said, they're not ready to see you yet in that role while you're doing sport, because then they'll think you're just, you know, you're using sport, or it's flighty and it's not.
Also, they'll think you're just fair weather.
Yeah, and I remember
you have to show your real sporting credentials and be committed.
Ian Wright's doing football and he's doing this massive entertainment show. And, you know, and he said, well, that's because he's a man, basically. You know, he didn't say it like that, but that's what he was saying to me. So at the time it felt grossly unfair, and I felt it was really sexist and I was really angry. But actually he was right, because the shift wasn't there yet. You know, people couldn't quite accept that you could do more than one thing.
And how did people take to you? Like, when you started, we didn't have social media then.
No, thank God. Kind
of, But did you get a sense of how you were being received by the audiences of these matches?
I suppose, and this shows you kind of how low the bar was for me, that I would, because I always went to a match on a Saturday after I presented a show called On the Ball, which was on the same time. It was just after on ITV CD UK. So you'd have Ant and Dec and Cat in the morning. And then
massive show, massive slot.
And then I'd come on afterwards with On the Ball. And we all worked around the same kind of time, you know, in that studio at ITV on the Thames. And then I'd get on a fast motorbike or a car and zoom to Stamford Bridge or somewhere for the 3 o'clock kickoff, just to watch as a fan. And I'd always have people coming up to me at the games going, oh, you're all right for a woman. You're all right for a woman. And but honestly, I was like, oh, thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Or they'd say things like, oh, right, you really do like football then? Because they could see me at a match. And go, yeah, I do really like football, yeah. And so I suppose there was a slight, oh, all right, she's all right. She seems okay. There was a reticence, definitely. But I was probably oblivious to a lot of antagonism because of the lack of social media. Because people, to get an insult to you, had to write a letter. And who could be bothered to do
that? That's an effort.
Right?
Yeah, you'd have to really, really want to insult
Most
you
Most of the letters
that
arrived were from people wanting weird things, like, have you got any tights left over, you know, things like that. So here's some chocolates for you. Right, okay. Letters were the only way you could really insult somebody, or a newspaper column. And actually I did become for a while the target of a couple of columnists who would have a go, and that was quite hard to deal with, because I hadn't experienced that level of negativity until now. Because on Sky I was pretty much under the radar, and then at ITV I was in people's homes, really in people's homes. The viewing figures, when you think about what they're like now to then. Millions and millions were watching those kinds of shows. And so I did then become slightly more public kind of property and targeted by certain sections of the press and certain individuals that take umbrage with you for whatever reason.
You and I have a lot of parallels in terms of our careers, in that I also was in a career in DJing that was entirely dominated by men and run by men. So I so relate to what you're saying about being like, well, thank you for accepting me. I'm just so happy to be here. This is a buzz. And also there was a sense when I started out DJing that I was a novelty. So like people were interested in me and I felt like being a woman was advantageous to my career. I'd never experienced full on sexism, not to my face anyway. But looking back, I do feel like, why did it take me so long to really want to pull through other women? And I wonder now, is it just because culturally it wasn't a thing, it wasn't done?
Well, they had their woman, didn't they? They didn't need another
one. They had their woman and I was the woman. But there was this strange moment and I always talk about it because it's so minuscule. I was DJing with a woman for some event, which is a really rare thing to be DJing with another woman. And I remember standing behind her waiting to go on after her, and she took her scrunchie out and just put her scrunchie back in. And I remember just looking at this and thinking, oh my God, it's so lovely to be sharing a DJ booth with another woman.
Yeah,
just getting this sense of like, why the hell hasn't this happened? And what's going on that this is just such a rare thing for me? And this sounds so dumb, like that I wasn't aware. Of course I was aware, but I suppose I never really thought that I could make a difference and change things.
Well, also, didn't you feel that perhaps if you did, somebody would decide, well, you're going to have to move on now. There might be another 100 blokes around, but actually there's this tiny corner here where the women are going to be allowed. So if you make space for somebody else, you're going to have to move on. You're going to, and there was, which sounds terrible to say it, because now I like you, I love it when I'm working with other women. I love having them around, and you know, just don't even see it anymore. You know, it just doesn't even cross my mind when I look at a call sheet and see how many women are on there. It's fantastic. But at the beginning of that change, there's, I suppose, a self-preservation as well, isn't there, where you feel like, oh, well, I was told by a boss at Sky I wouldn't be on telly after the age of 28, so maybe he's right. You know, the other women are coming. It's time for me to move on.
But it's also a sense of, I don't feel like I have the power to be able to make this difference, you know. And if I did start shouting about it, you know, it's kind of that. So I suppose what I'm trying to ask is, was there a sense in your career where you felt like, not just that things were changing, but that you could implement that. You could help speak to people, influence people in order to have more women around you.
Yeah, when I started to feel more confident, I suppose, about what I was doing, and that probably came, you know, around the same time as having kids, because that was 32. I'd had a terrible experience at ITV. A new boss came in, didn't want me to be the lead presenter. I thought that was the end for me. You know, I thought, oh, I'm finished.
Then having kids as well on top.
I was literally still carrying one-year-old twins in my arms at this point when he's having phone calls with me and sending me home from World Cups and things. And so,
oh my God.
And thank God the BBC had a show they wanted me to front, and they also wanted me to be involved in their Olympic coverage, ultimately their rugby and football and other things. At the same time, I managed to move from ITV to the BBC, and that was a new beginning. And my confidence took a big hit for a while, I'd say a year. But once I got my chops back and I felt more confident, that's when I think I started to find my voice a bit more about, you know, being able to say, actually, it might have been, first of all, regarding women's sport, you know, that why are we not showing more women's sport? Why have we not got, you know, these? So it was those conversations where I probably found my voice earlier on. And then looking at across the room and working out that we didn't have women, you know, fronting other programmes. And Claire Balding was already at the BBC. Sue Barker had been doing tennis, but Claire was a bit more multi-sport, and Hazel. And they, I felt, were also starting to find their voices. So, you know, I was lucky to be in that vanguard of women who were able to speak up and say, right, okay, let's have a look. What's fair here? Oh, there's only 2% of coverage across all mainstream media this year has been women's sport. We need to redress this, you know. And so starts to build. And I think you get things like the Olympic Games in 2012, where it felt like there was a massive shift in the perception of what women could achieve in sport, and that more women from Great Britain won golds than men. And that kind of moment where you're part of that movement, and it becomes a lot more comfortable and a lot more enjoyable to start the conversation. Yeah.
But why the hell has it taken so long for it to be worthy of attention? Women's sport, I mean.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? That you look back now, I look back to my childhood, and I was talking to somebody about this the other day. Saturday mornings, there was a show called Trans World Sport on Channel 4, and it showed things like kabaddi and all these kind of really alternative sports. And they always had about a 4-minute window of rhythmic gymnastics, which was my sport. So I always tried to watch it. And I look back now and think that was the only place I saw women doing sport, was that programme probably across the week, unless Wimbledon was on, or unless the Olympics were on, where, you know, we'd have the odd athlete who was highlighted. That was probably it. And it's incredible that, and if you can't, you see, I know it's a cliche, but if you can't see it, you can't be it. You don't think you can be it. You don't think it's that, you know, who is it? Yeah. Who's there for me to look up to? So not having these role models for young girls, not having professional sport for young girls, you know, if you're a young girl trying to persuade your family that you should be able to do sport, and there's no pathway as a career in sport, then they just think you're wasting your time and your opportunities, which is what I hear time and time again from people of my age who have great sporting credentials and great sporting talent, but never actually managed to use it in any meaningful way or any kind of career. When I was born, football was banned. So I couldn't have been a professional footballer, because that wasn't a possibility for me as a child, that because football had been banned for 50 more years.
It's just really important to take this out for a second and just remind our listeners that it was not possible to play women's football until year?
Until the 70s, until the early
70s. Until the 70s, so it was banned.
But even then...
Why was it banned, Gabby?
Well,
why?
Because it became popular. Because during the war, the Second World War in particular, when men got sent off to fight, people still wanted to watch football. And so these women's football teams started attracting tens of thousands of crowds. There was a team called the Dick Kerr Ladies, who were from a munitions factory, and they were really famous because they attracted such huge crowds. They were absolutely brilliant, winning everything. And then the men came back from war, and suddenly there was an edict from the FA that actually it wasn't safe for them to play football, because the ball might hit their abdomen, and then that would affect their child rearing possibilities. And there were all kinds
of,
there were lots of spurious kind of reasons that that were given. One was the safety for women, and then it was banned. And so organised football for women in this country was banned, and women were not allowed to play. So obviously nobody could stop a child in the back garden taking her brother's football, or whatever. But actually going out and playing in a team, playing at school, not even a possibility until the 70s. But even when the 70s came along, there was nothing organised, nothing set up. It was just, and by this point, by the way, in Norway, they already had like semi-professional footballers, and the Scandinavian countries. Yeah. And of course, in America, it was growing at the same rate as men's games. So in America, which is why they've been so dominant in global football, the American women, they grew up playing football alongside their brothers. There was never a period of time where it was unusual for girls and boys to play together. It was never seen as a boys' sport in America, ever. Mm. And so we were such an anathema in that respect. And actually makes it even more incredible how well the women have done since they picked it back up again.
Yeah, so they've had literally 50 years entirely like reinvigorate a sport.
We're not actually that far away. We're kind of within a generation away from a time when it was really poor, the options and the possibilities for women. So it's really the last 15 years things have changed dramatically for the women in this country. I mean, I remember when the BBC played, had an FA Cup, a women's FA Cup final a few years ago. Before I worked for the BBC, I was watching this match, and even on the coverage, the commentators were saying, maybe they should just reduce the goals because the goalkeepers aren't good enough. And so it's not that long ago that people were saying things like that openly. Now, it's amazing how the standard of goalkeeping at the last World Cup in Australia last summer was actually lauded for how brilliant it was.
Yeah.
And by the way, they didn't reduce the goals. Do you know what they did? They actually got goalkeeping coaches, because what they realised was that these women were not actually coached. So, and it's like Rachel Brown-Finnis, who used to be the England goalkeeper, has talked about this a lot, that how, isn't it amazing how when you actually get a goalkeeping coach, which boys have had like since the beginning of time, that the women suddenly became great goalkeepers. So of course, women have different challenges in goalkeeping for the women's game. But we didn't see in the last World Cup these huge 10-0 drubbings or massive. It was a really tight World Cup. So all those things have improved. The standard of play has improved and the quality and the coverage.
It's great. I love
it. It's symbolic of other things in society. That's why I always say to my daughter's never played football, really. She's played a little bit at school. She's got other sports. During the Women's World Cup in 19, when England got to the semis, I was away in France. I came home and she said, "Mum, all the girls at school are talking about the Women's World Cup." And she was 13 at the time. I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, it's amazing. They're all talking about it." Now, those girls in her class weren't going to become women's footballers, but what would that have shown them about what was possible? What are the things, other things in society that they felt weren't for them, might have given them an idea? And that for me was the really joyous bit about that whole, you know, campaign and feeling like girls were talking. And I remember my builder was at the house doing something for us, and he's a massive kind of sports fan generally. And when I came back, the first thing he wanted to talk about was Ellen White and her goal scoring. And I was like, my God, if Carl Edwards is talking to me about Ellen White, then we have moved something here.
It's so exciting. And I also want to say, like, just with regards to football and women's football, so many women, and I spoke to Leah Williamson about this on this podcast, stop sport in puberty. Mm. They stop competitive sport. But there's such a whole world out there to still play sport for the love of it. Mm. And watching the Euros for me, which I watched in Ireland with my sons, and honestly, I just found it so deeply moving, because I was a baller when I was in primary school. I was like the one of two girls on the boys team. And then I stopped and then moved to England, wasn't brave enough to join a team. I've started playing football again, Gabby.
Hey!
And I'm 45.
That's amazing.
I've joined like a local women's club, and I can't stop talking about it to anyone who will listen. But I just love it. And I think if it wasn't for watching the Euros and reminding myself of how much I used to love it, and maybe thinking that it could still be for me, I wouldn't have had the, I'm not going to say balls, because that's not literally correct, the boobs, whatever it is. I wouldn't have had the nerve to like walk into a club and say like, "Can I have a go?"
Yeah. Women, though, generally, I think, probably much more reticent to do that than, I don't think a bloke would have that crisis of confidence to do that, because they've grown up with it all the way. So you get some guys I know who were terrible at football, but they still carried on playing, even though they were never going to be a professional. Whereas, this is going back to my point earlier, I always feel like women almost, as you say, the puberty thing is huge, and it still is, sadly, girls dropping out of sport. And we really, that's a big area of, I think, a target, I think, for any government. You've got to keep women and young girls playing sports throughout. But it's also that confidence thing about, am I in the right place as a woman?
Right.
You know, is this the right place for me? And I just hope that the younger generations do not see or feel that at all now. They feel like their place is anywhere they want it to be, and they can play football all through their teens and into their 20s just for the hell of it, because they really love
it. And into their 40s,
yes,
if you're listening.
And your 50s. Yeah. Well, I had Rachel Burden on my podcast, The Midpoint, last week from 5 Live, and she does walking football. So even if you think you
aren't, no way, I never knew that existed.
Yes, well, she talks about it on 5 Live quite a bit. So I asked her about it, and you know walking in the Olympics, like the speed walking or the 30K walk? Yeah. It's the same rule. You can't have one foot has to be on the ground at all times. She actually managed to break her ankle playing walking football. So it's obviously quite physical.
I never heard of that. That's amazing.
So beyond your 50s, into your 60s.
Okay, Gabby, let's ask the final change question. The change you would still like to make moving forwards. And that can be for your own life, but it could also be for the world around you. It's a pretty vast question.
Yeah, I know. And apologies. I had said, I think I was feeling, when I was first asked this question, I was feeling quite despondent about the world that day, and feeling like I want the change in the world to be everybody to start being kind to each other. And, you know, just feeling like people take a bit of time to notice other people. And if people are different, people live different lives, and just acceptance feels like everything's gone very binary. You know, you're either this or you're that. And I sometimes listen to people and think, God, how are these people so convinced by their own opinions? You know, and it feels like people are very entrenched, and that middle area of maybe thinking that you could change your mind on something, it seems to have disappeared. You've got to be one thing or another. And I wish we could change that. You know, I appreciate that that's not a change I might see in my lifetime, but I would love that to happen. But on a very personal level, the change I would like is, I'm currently training for a half marathon. I would like to wake up tomorrow morning and find out that I am a natural runner after all. Every run I do, is tough. And I've never found that run. I get runner's high, but I don't ever get a runner's feeling of, oh God, I could just carry on for another 20 miles. The problem I've got is I decided the other day, I work with Paula Radcliffe, Steve Cram,
my God.
Jessica Ennis Hill. And I'm watching all these other amazing young athletes running. And I think, oh God, why do I not look like that when I run? I'd like to look like a gazelle when I run. So yeah, so on a completely selfish and self-absorbed change, I'd like to wake up tomorrow morning and find I am indeed a 20-year-old Paula Radcliffe. And I can just run with ease. That would be lovely.
Gabby, thank you so much for chatting with me today. It's been an absolute honour. And don't forget, if you're listening, to check out the Sports Agent podcast. I've really been enjoying it, actually. I love the Chris Horner episode, especially because it just really gives you the lowdown on all of these things in sport that you might not know everything about. And it's really fun and entertaining as well. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
If you enjoy Changes, please do rate, review and subscribe to the podcast. Share it with your friends and family. Go on social media. Tell everyone about it. Tag me, Annie McManus. I always love to see how you react to these episodes. And it's just so helpful to be seen and to be shared by you lot. So thank you so much if you do. There's a whole catalogue of episodes to listen to. If you have missed any at all, go back and check them out. And we'll be back next week. Changes is produced by Louise Mason with assistant production from Anna DeWolf Evans. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.